Blog Talk Radio.
The icon, the number one guy in this business, the Tornado, Tony Pennycal.
All right, and tonight we have a special guest on at the 8:30 time slot. We have Dellen Parsley, who is a boxing prospect, and he is 4-0 with two knockouts, I believe. But I'm not sure because there's a heavyweight, Dellen Parsley, and there's a super middleweight, I think. Light middleweight, so I don't know if he came down in weight or what. It looks like I got the right one at light middleweight here. He's 4-0, two knockouts, and he has a fight coming up. If I can get this thing to load properly here, I'll tell you who he's fighting next. There we go. David Lopez, who's 3-4. He's fighting him on the 29th this month in New York City at the BB King Blues Club and Grill. And he's one of Yano's guys. We tried to get two guests on tonight, but when I had the time to make the phone call to the other potential guest, he was at the store and it left his phone with somebody else. So it didn't sound like the guy was ready to leave a message. So I just went with Dellen, and we'll try to get Jaron Cochran on next week. It just seems to be getting some guys with some weird names. Where these guys get their names.
If you can fight good, that's all that matters, right?
Yeah, right. So we'll have the prospect on later. And, of course, we got a lot of big news to cover, as always. We had a big fight this past weekend in MMA. I was glued to because a local guy from New England there, he's actually from New York, but he fought through the New England circuits there, and I saw him in person myself one time. He had a pretty decent fight, pretty amazing fight, actually, against Mauricio Shogun Hua. And if you follow MMA, you know I'm talking about John Bones Jones. And interestingly enough, before he had his actual title fight, he tracked down a mugger in New Jersey and kicked the guy's ass with a couple of his coach and a couple of his coaches, I guess. And I think he got the guy in an arm bar or whatever and held him down until the cops got there. But they were originally running after him. And then all of a sudden, Jones just comes flying by the two other coaches, got to him first, and then they held him down. But such an interesting story for a guy whose star was already rising, you know, before the fight even started. He had just gotten all this crazy attention. And then he gets into the fight and just was demolishing him every single round. He was winning just unbelievably. And there's one point where, you know, it really would start feeling bad for the other guy. I mean, he's been in the sport forever. And here he is getting kicked around the ring, and his eye was almost swollen shut. And he's just getting hit with so many elbows and punches and knees. And a knee was actually what put him down on the mat and finished him. But, of course, like we began the show with last week, talking about Martinez there, the pound for pound call after his performance. It's Martinez, right?
Yeah, that was we're talking about some of the up and coming pound for pound guys. And Martinez obviously is up there, and Nonito Tenera is up there.
Right. Well, a similar thing happened with John Bones Jones after his fight, where all kinds of people are out there saying he's the best in the sport right now, nobody can beat him, he should be fighting Anderson Silva. And, of course, he's got to fight Rashad Evans first, who just unleashed a whole another league of controversy because of the win. Because those two guys trained at the same camp. And basically, Rashad Evans is pissed at this point because John Bones Jones said he would never fight him. And these guys at this camp are notorious for not fighting each other, no matter what. And Jones has made some statements saying, you know, he had to keep his job. So that's why he agreed to take that fight. But the thing that really hasn't been talked a lot about is, well, Jones and Rashad are never supposed to fight, then why didn't Rashad back out of it? You know? Or what's his responsibility in this whole deal? So it was kind of an interesting question that nobody seems to be talking about. You know, if it's that much of a problem for him, why doesn't he just agree not to fight? But obviously he's doing some stuff to keep his job too, because he said that they sent him into the cage after that fight to have the face-off there with Jones, and he didn't want to do it. He didn't even want to go in the cage to do that. But apparently they used to be friends. Now they're not quite friends anymore. Of course, Jones is very religious. He has a passage from the Bible tattooed on his shoulder, so he's definitely a religious guy. And Rashad knows this, of course, and he called him Judas because of so it's just a whole new controversy. It's going to be pretty interesting. Actually, on Ariel Helwani's show the other day that I was listening to, he brought up something interesting that this will only be the second time that two African-American fighters are fighting for a title belt in the main event on a UFC event. So that in itself is sort of interesting. It's a new story. But we don't know when that fight will be. Jones has actually had two quick fights, so he's going to take some time off. And, you know, as far as the pound-for-pound best talk, and, you know, he's unstoppable. Like I said last week about the boxer, I'd like to see him fight a couple more times and defend that belt before we start calling for him to fight the best of the best. You know? But we'll see if he lives up to the hype. I think he can, but I think it's a little too early to be saying, you know, he's the best, especially when you consider as good as Hua is as far as he's gone in the sport and he's been around. He wasn't at his best in that fight, and he really doesn't seem to be, as far as I can see, one of the elite fighters anymore. He's like more one of those older type of guys who just keeps getting kicked around by the younger kids who have a more well-rounded game. So we'll see. The jury's still out, but I definitely don't want to take anything away from his performance. A lot of people have been picking apart the fact that he was a little bit gassed at certain points, but it wasn't like he let that affect him. And as the fight went on, it was clear that, you know, no matter how exhausted he was at certain points, his opponent was doing a lot worse. So, but there was a whole other fight card attached. Let's go over that real quickly in a second here. But Hua just didn't have anything, you know, that he could respond with. So, of course, it's going to make Jones look better. But probably the most surprising thing was just the unorthodox style of of Jones. He hit him one time with a spinning back elbow. I had never seen anything like that in a fight. And he just spun around, elbowed him right in the face. So that was very, very interesting. We also had a fight, actually, when I did the preview piece, I picked exactly the way it would go down. It reminded me of the days when I used to do the boxing predictions, but I actually almost got every single fight right this time. I think it was like two of them that I got wrong. But I got the winners of all the rest of them out of the 12. But the fight I'm talking about was in the first round, and it was Luis Arthur Kane Jr. versus Elliot Marshall. And Kane won by TKO at the 2:15 period time mark. We also had Eric Koch versus Rafael Asuncao. Koch won by KO. Nick Catone versus Konstantinos Filippou, won by decision. Catone won by decision. And then Joseph Benavidez versus Ian Loveland. It was a unanimous decision. Gleison Tebow beat Kurt Pellegrino by decision, split decision. Mike Pyle beats Ricardo Almeida by decision, unanimous. And Edson Mendez Barboza Jr. and Anthony Njokuani also ended in a unanimous decision that was a little bit controversial. Barboza landed an unbelievable kick to the head to close the third round. But another thing I noticed on that Ariel Helwani show the other day was that they counted up, or they found the statistics for the punch stat statistics that you would see in boxing. They had strikes for the MMA. And Joe Kawani had just demolished him in that category. But there was a few other different issues with takedowns and, you know, the aspect of did those strikes actually hurt the opponent. And the last kick of the fight from Barboza just about knocked Joe Kawani right out. So I think that was the deciding factor for the judges. And, you know, as always in any combat sport, the last thing the judges see is going to be what they remember. But also we had another legend get taken out of the game, Mirko Filipovic, who is better known as Crow Cop, got his butt kicked by Brendan Schaub, and he knocked him out in the third round with a right hand. Put him right in the ground. Didn't even seem like that bad of a punch. It just like grazed his head in such a way it was like right near the temple, so it dropped him right away. And Filipovic actually was doing pretty well. He banged up Schaub pretty good, had him cut twice over one of his eyes. His nose looked like it was broken. Just all banged up. But of course, UFC being ultra competitive like they are, they kicked Crow Cop to the curb right after the fight. Then we had a few more fights. Nate Marquardt versus Dan Miller ended by unanimous decision. Marquardt won that one. The other Miller won his fight against our former guest, Kamal Shalrous, by punches. And unfortunately, I thought that was the fight of the night, really, you know, because those guys, they battled till the final knockout, and none of them got bonuses. And Kamal Shalrous was doing all right. He was hanging in there until that third round when Miller just unloaded on him, dropped him to the canvas, and just started throwing elbows and punches and the works, and just really banged him up good. But they gave the fight of the night to the Barboza versus Njokuani fight because obviously there was a little bit of controversy, and I think they just wanted to keep both guys happy. But finally, there was Uriah Faber versus Eddie Wineland. Faber won by unanimous decision, something I definitely predicted. Didn't surprise me at all. So that was it. John Jones won in the third round, of course. and the time was 2:37. But that's about it. That's all for that big show. And then there's going to be, we'll have a little bit of time later, we're going to have to go over the event this weekend, which is a fight night event. So we'll check that out and go over that schedule a little bit later. Well, what did we have in boxing this last weekend? Did you catch any boxing? Did you at least get the news?
Unfortunately, did not get to see any, but I got to read some. I did not get to see the Klitschko fight. Of course, that was aired on internet or whatever, but that turned out to be a woeful disappointment. I don't know if you heard about it. This is the older Klitschko, Vitaly. He was fighting Orlando Solis, undefeated Cuban Olympian. And there was a couple trains of thought on it. Solis was the Olympic gold medalist back in 2000 at 200 pounds, which is, I guess, considered, heavyweight now. I mean, now they got super heavyweight in the Olympics also. So he was undefeated as a pro, but most of his pro fights, he's been fighting at like 260 plus. And a lot of people are, and you know, he looks really soft in the midsection. A lot of people are saying, well, if he comes in shape, he's got a good chance of beating him. Well, he did. He came in about a good, 12 to 15 pounds lighter. Came in at like 248 pounds and said he looked pretty good. First round, I guess they were, moving around. And next thing you know, Solis was on the canvas. And he blew out his knee, ruptured his ACL, and I think his patellar tendon. So the fight just was stopped, went in the books as a first-round TKO. Nothing meaningful happened during the entire 2 minutes or so of the fight. So, very much a disappointment. So everybody lost on that. Vitaly was mad. He was like, he thought Solis was faking it. Then he was trying to say it was the object of was the result of a punch, which was never confirmed. The fans obviously lost. Solis obviously lost big time. Not only did he lose, in this title fight, but his career is now in jeopardy. He's going to be out for no less than ACL injury. In football, that's it, out for the season. So you don't know how long he'll be out of a boxing ring for, be able to train, and knowing knee injuries, and I've never had an ACL injury like that, but I've had some knee problems, and after I had my knee, worked on in 96, if you watch any of my films for the entire upcoming fight year after that, I couldn't push off. I was so flat-footed because I was getting no leverage pushing off my back foot. This is obviously going to potentially ruin Solis's career. Also, then we had the Showtime card that was Lucien Bute fighting in front of his, hometown faithful. And he layeth the smack it down on Brian McGee, stopping in the 10th round. But he pretty much beat up on him pretty good.
Right, I did hear about that, and kind of seemed odd, but Yano has a fightpickexperts.com page now, and he picked McGee to go down by body shot in a little video preview he did, but I didn't see it before the fight. I saw it after the fight. I wonder if he just did. I don't know if Yano was... somebody would do that, but just kind of was funny to me, because I went on there and there he is, talking about, oh yeah, he's going to go down late in the fight by body shots, and that's exactly how it went,
If you watch any of Lucien Bute's fights, that's generally how he has been taking guys out lately. He had that first fight with I'm forgetting the guy's name. I'm feeling like an idiot here. The guy my dad really likes, the Mexican fighter with the iron jaw. But that's what Bute did to him. He went right down to the body. their first fight, you know, BJ was, you know, out on his feet. Second fight, you know, he just went right down to the body and, you know, broke him down, took him out with a shot. That's how he beat Jesse Brinkley. He beat him to the body. So that's what BJ's got. He's got that, you know, he's a southpaw. And that's what he likes to do. He likes to get in there and, you know, get inside and, you know, drive that left uppercut of the solar plexus. And it's been devastating so far.
Right. Well, we have a big fight coming up tomorrow night with ESPN Friday Night Fights out here in Vegas at the Cosmopolitan. And ironically, there's a guy that was connected to the Zions situation that I met just yesterday who was staying over at the Cosmopolitan. So I got an advanced look at the casino area and the hotel lobby. I haven't seen the actual venue yet, but they're opening it up for the fights around noon for the press tomorrow. So I'm going to try to check it out and get in there. I got my press pass confirmation, so I'm ready to go. So we'll have a little bit of a report on that thing when I get there. I'm not sure if it's going to be able to be live. We'll have to see if they have the, the Wi-Fi. They do have a laptop here with Wi-Fi, so we could be doing live Twitter updates and Facebook, like the real reporters. that'll be interesting. That'll be a first for me, because usually if I did have a laptop for my reporting duties in the past, it was just to type the stuff up and make notes. So that will definitely be a first if we can do that. But Arislandi Lara is in the main event Friday against Carlos Molina. Lara is 15-0 with 10 knockouts, and his last four fights have ended with first round knockouts. So it should be definitely pretty interesting. Molina is 17-4-1 and has never been knocked down, so it's going to be a tough thing for Lara to go in there and continue that full fight knockout in the first round streak. But the other thing about this fight is it's probably going to put Lara, if he wins, in position for a title fight. He's ranked number 5 by the WBA and number 10 in the WBC. So perhaps, we don't know, but maybe Miguel Cotto or Sergio Martinez could be in his future. But we shall see. We don't want to crown him king yet. Let me get to BoxRec here, and we'll check out the rest of that schedule.
I'm telling you, I'm looking forward to the fight card on ESPN next Friday night. It's one of our old guests and a good friend of mine, Hammer and Hank Lundy, still rebounding his career for that loss last July.
Right.
He's fighting a guy by the name of Patrick Lopez, who's 20-3. Hammer and Hank just, I just connected with him on Facebook, so I'm going to maybe, after this fight, try to get him back on for another interview, because I'll be pretty sure we lost last talk to him 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. That long ago, huh? Time flies. Well, it is strange, interestingly enough, you know, speaking of guys that we used to have on or we had on before, we talked last week about TNT Tucker, Mark Tucker there.
Yeah.
Well, since then, we had some comments left on his YouTube page, or his YouTube video that I filmed down in Dorchester when he came to my hometown where I grew up, Dorchester, Massachusetts. I don't know if it was last year or the year before, it was probably the year before, but when I was living down there, I actually got to go there and I filmed his fight. And somebody was pretty much bad-mouthing him on this YouTube video. And it sounded like somebody who knew him responded right away and mentioned there was something to do with the sickness. There was a sickness going around, some kind of bug that a lot of people in that area were getting. And that, you know, not that it's an outright excuse, but it's an explanation at least for why he didn't feel like himself and didn't do that great in that fight. So could have just been a fluke for all we know. It's interesting. But, let's get to...
It really pisses me off about, like, you know, social sites like, you know, YouTube, Facebook, MySpace, and this and that. It's like, even chat rooms, it just gives you the chance to have all these internet tough guys, you know, constantly like running their mouths. And you know, it just irks the living shit out of me sometimes. So I got, you know, a couple of YouTube videos, and for the most part, you know, on some of my fighting videos, everybody's been pretty professional, pretty nice. I do have one video I took at the Wing Bowl in Philadelphia last year, and Snooki was there. And the Philadelphia fans were booing her because she's ugly and obnoxious and, you know, a fake wannabe, you know, 15 minutes of fame, waste of time. And so a lot of people were like, either you're pro her or you're anti her, and now people are like leaving all these messages like derogatory, like, oh, shut up, you know, you're always watching the show and this and that. I'm like, well, first of all, I'm not watching the show. I was at the Wing Bowl. She was there. I was videoing. We booed her. The end. Then you have this other one. The one that kind of pissed me off more than anything. I don't know where this guy was from. I don't. He like reading the way he would write on there. He sounded like he was, like, Ivan Drago from, like, you know, Siberia, Russia or whatever. But I had a video, and I think you've seen it, where I did instructions on wrapping your hands. And this guy's like, you are not a boxer. That is not the way a boxer would wrap hands. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, and then I looked at one of his videos, and he was, like, criticizing other people. And he was like, I saw some of the other videos he commented on. And he would, like, write stuff like, you do not wrap hands to protect hands. You wrap hands to hurt your opponent. Really? That's idiotic. And then I watched one video, him wrapping his hands, and all he did was he wrapped it around, like, the wrist a couple times. With, now, we all use different kind of wraps, and we all have different techniques. I concentrate most of my wrapping in three stages. I start off with the wrist. I go two times. I know a lot of people start off with four or five. I remember you even said you start off like six times around the wrist. Yeah. I start off twice around the wrist. I, you know, I do an X across the hand. I go around the knuckles. I go around the thumb. And then I use a gauze type wrap, which is a lot softer. It mimics what real gauze feels like. And then I go around the knuckles, and I have another set of gauze layered back and forth to be like a traditional knuckle pad, which is a way that the pros get their hands wrapped. So I do that, and then I end on the wrist. So I get a good at least four times around the wrist, two at the start and two at the end. But I also get the concentration around the knuckles. I'm watching this guy, and it was all around the wrist and the back of the hand. Literally no protection on the knuckles. And I said, you know what, I'm not even going to, you know, email this guy back. I'm not going to do it because he's just an idiot. But I would, you know, I wouldn't tell him, you know, I was like, son, if you ever came into my gym like that, we'd toss your ass right the hell out.
Yeah, actually, when I was taught how to do it, they told me, I think it was when I was at the Air Force Academy, it was when I got my first lesson, and they told me that the real major purpose of the wrap is not primarily to protect your hands. It's more to reinforce the wrist because, you know, you can break your wrist if you don't wrap the wrist right. So, you know, obviously, yeah, it's also to protect the knuckles and the hands from injury. But, you know, the only thing that that does that more than the wraps is, the, like you said, the knuckle pads. So, I don't know. Everybody has a different philosophy, but I always thought that it is true that if you wrap the wrist better, you tend to injure yourself less and strain that area less when you're doing high impact punching and hitting the bag and all that. But to each his own. Anyway, just want to finish out this Cosmopolitan card before we get our guest on the phone, Dylan Parsley, in a minute. We have at the top of the card a light middleweight fight between Udell Johnson, who's 9-0, six knockouts, fighting Richard Gutierrez, who's 26-5 with one draw and 16 knockouts. And we have sort of a mismatch here. Junior Dorticos at cruiserweight, fighting a six-rounder. He's 11-0 with 11 knockouts, fighting William Mitch Williams, who's three.
Wild thing.
Three knockouts, one draw. William Williams. How do you get a name like that? Also, we have another six-rounder, lightweight Highland Williams Jr., 12-0 with three knockouts, fighting James Lester, who's 9-4 with four knockouts. And the only other card that's set and final here is Hiromitsu Mura, who is light heavyweight, six-rounder, fighting Todd Manuel, and both guys are undefeated. One is 5-0 with three knockouts. The other is, and that's Mura. And then Manuel is 4-0 with no knockouts. So I don't know how many of these fights I'm going to get to see, but I'm going to try to see as many as I can get to. But I also wanted to mention real quick before we get Dylan on the phone, there's a female fight in Mexico on Friday, bantamweight 10-rounder, main event, mismatch of the week, mismatch of the century almost. We have Zulina Munoz, 26-1 with 19 knockouts and two draws, fighting Judith Rodriguez, 1-2. For the WBC Youth Female Bantamweight title, no less. So,
Judith, okay.
If Judith pulls off the upset of the century, then she'll get a title as a 2-2 fighter. Won't that be so nice? Anyway, let's connect with Dylan Parsley, see what he has to tell us about his budding career in boxing and how he got the name Dylan, which I've never heard before. Parsley is another one. It's an interesting last name. Dylan Parsley, D-E-L-E-N, is how you spell it. You ever heard of that name?
No, I haven't.
Dylan.
Hey, what's
up? Hey, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron. How's it going?
I'm good.
And we also have on the line our boxing expert, Tony the Tornado.
What's going on, man?
So
much.
Everything's
good.
So I was looking at your record. It looks like you got a fight coming up on the 29th, right? Is that still going?
Yeah, that's still on.
David Lopez, what do you know about that guy?
Yeah. Not much, really. I know he's a southpaw, and that's about it. He's a crafty southpaw.
All right. And how did you get involved in boxing in the first place?
My dad was a fighter a while ago, so I just kind of fell into it. My uncle was a fighter. So.
All right. And you've had four fights, two knockouts so far. What's your ultimate goal with the sport?
Take it to the top, be world champion, which every fighter should, you know, have aspirations to be. So that's my main goal, is to be up there in the ranks with the champions and become a legend. Just, you know, be a household name.
All right. And
I'm
go ahead, Tony.
I'm taking a look at your fight record here. 4-0 with two knockouts. The one fight, excuse me, that I'm taking a look at that actually is very impressive to me, because it's a fighter that I covered back a few years ago, was a win you had about a year ago, a stoppage win over a fighter by the name of John Michael Terry. He does not have a good record. He was in Aston, Pennsylvania. John Michael, I mean, if anybody looks at his records, he's 2-15-3, and they don't think much about the guy. But I had the opportunity to cover him. He's a guy, you know, he's, you know, from down in Virginia. And I remember commenting to my dad that the guy's got a lot more talent than he gets credit for. And I saw him take a couple pretty good fighters and really give them a lot of hell, you know, on some top cards. And like I said, he just wasn't getting, you know, the training that he needs. But he's a good measuring stick for anybody. And I saw him take some pretty good Philadelphia fighters the distance. And it looks like you stopped him in 3 rounds. Now, what can you tell us about that fight?
That fight was a good learning. He's a very tough guy. But when I went in the ring, like, I just boxed him. I just boxed him, kept on the end of my jab, and I just set a lot of the punches up, and I ended up stopping it on a cut. So he's good. He's better than his record shows. He's strong. He could take a good shot. But I just think the accumulation of punches that added up and the cut at the end really stopped him in that fight.
All right. Now, I noticed there was 2 Dellen Parsleys in the system there. Is that your other uncle? Is he related?
That's my dad.
That's your dad. Oh. So your dad was in too.
He
didn't that. I thought you said it was your uncle that was in the fight.
No, my uncle's Bob Stallone. He fought a long time ago.
Oh, right.
And my dad trained with him. My dad also fought.
Cool. So how do you get a name like Dellen? And obviously you're named after your father, but...
I have no clue. I thought it was from where he was born. He was born in Dillon, South Carolina, but that's Dillon. I don't know where Dillon came from. So.
All right.
I don't know the origin of that.
And you have a fighting nickname?
The Sniper.
The Sniper. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That is a good one.
Huh?
Tony said it's a good one.
Yeah, that is a good one.
Now, do you have a favorite punch that you like to go to for the knockout, or did you just use
my left hook to the body.
Left hook to the
that's
body.
Nice. Yeah, that sets up better because I'm tall, so I get a lot of left.
Look, we lost everybody for a second. We all back?
Yeah, we're here. We're all here. I was going to ask you about your pro debut. Pro debut, which was a win at the Prudential Center in Newark, New Jersey, on the undercard of a Thomas Adamack title defense. Thomas Adamack is a fighter that we've covered a couple times on Fight News Unlimited. And Prudential, when he fights, almost, you know, becomes a madhouse. What was it like fighting in that type of environment in front of that type of crowd for your pro debut?
It was scary at first, but once you're in there, you kind of don't really notice as many people and all the people around you just focused on the fighter in front of you. But I'm glad I got to be in that kind of fight, that kind of atmosphere, because it gets you over the intimidation factor fast instead of having to wait till later on and some people can't handle the pressure and they fold up in the fight. It was really good. It was cool. It was real cool.
Yeah, actually, back in 2007, I was at the Prudential Center for one of the UFC fights there. I think it was UFC 178, so that's a very nice venue.
Very nice. It's big. It fills up really quick.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good time. Now, obviously, you said you had some family in the boxing game. Did you have any other role models outside of boxing that helped you out along the way?
Yeah. Jersey Joe Walcott was I watched him plenty of times. I watched Floyd. I learned from everybody. I've trained with John Guzman. I learned a lot from him, Vivian Harris, Zab Judah. And I grew up around a lot of these guys, so... I learned a lot from them. And just watching boxing in general, you could take little bits and pieces from tons of fighters and just take the bad and leave it in the bad, take the good for the good.
Yeah, just don't take any hints from Floyd's personal life, right?
Oh, no, definitely not.
He's going to be in court before he's in the ring.
Yeah, I get a lot of good sparring from my cousin, Dennis Duglin, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dennis Duglin, is that what you said?
Yeah, the mama's boy, yeah.
Yeah.
Mama's boy, yeah, we had him on, what, about 3 weeks ago, Rich?
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah,
maybe
cousin.
A month ago at most, so that's kind of funny.
Yeah, he just had his first loss on right after we talked to him, didn't he?
Oh.
Yeah, I was there.
No, but don't worry, we're not a jinx, so.
Put it in that light, Tony. Oh, yeah, he just lost it after he talked to him.
Yeah, well, I right after we talked to him, I remember reading about him again first loss. But I said, we're not a jinx.
You just got called a good shot. Things happen.
Well, absolutely, things happen. A very good friend of mine. We were talking about it last night. We've had him on the air a couple times. When he was first starting out, and I'm going back about 12 years ago, it was his first amateur fight. He's now like 18-1 as a professional. His first amateur fight was my his name's Chuck Masaccio. He's a light heavyweight out of Jersey, and I was kind of working with him at the time because I was a my boxing eligibility in college was up, and I still had a semester to go before graduating, so I was kind of helping the team out, and being an Italian, I was mentoring the young Italian guy that was quote unquote taking my spot on the roster, and his very first fight, fighting a big husky kid out of this upstate Pennsylvania school. And we were holding a fight in an athletic center in mid-afternoon. And the way the sun was coming in, the wind, it was like a basketball, like, it was like the basketball gym where the fights were being held. And just the way the sun was coming in, you were getting this horrible glare when you faced the one side of the ring just for only a half hour. And we told him before the fight, no matter what you do, keep your back to the red corner. Or keep your back to the blue corner, and he was in the red corner. We're like, keep your back to the blue corner. And he was moving around, he was dancing, he was using good movements. He was outboxing the guy. And he moved, and he had his back to the red corner, and the sun went right in his eyes, and the guy threw a haymaker and knocked him out cold. and that was, his first loss in his first amateur fight. And but he went on to be a 2-time national champ, and, now he's doing very well as a pro. And what was funny about that, the very next fight of the night, we had this big, big heavyweight on our team, this guy Demetrius. He was huge, but he was one of the funnier guys on the team. And we said, Demetrius, keep your back to the blue corner. And he came out of the red corner, the bell rang, and he literally ran in a circle around the ring and got his back to the blue corner after seeing that happen.
Nice.
You learn your lesson?
So, yeah, anybody can get called a shot.
Yeah, anybody.
Well, beyond planning for the inconceivable things like that, what would you say you do that's most important in preparing for a fight, Don?
But I do a lot of running cardio, like, because there's nothing worse than having somebody beat and have no gas left in the tank to finish the fight.
Right.
I do a lot of cardio. I'm a very quick fighter, so I do a lot of, like, it's an old thing that they used to do in Philly a lot that we just started doing and bringing into our whole training thing, where you put a quarter in the middle of the ring and you keep your foot on that quarter and you don't move from that spot. And whoever you spawn, you try not to be hit as much as possible.
That's a new one. I haven't heard of that.
Right in the pocket.
But that's definitely a good way to learn footwork and stuff, and bobbing and weaving and defense. We used to have a drill at the Air Force Academy where I spent my freshman year, where you just get in the corner and cover up, and you couldn't throw a single punch back. And the other guy would just unload on you, and then you'd switch places.
To
this day, that's one of the best ways you can teach somebody on how to block the body more than the head. I mean, usually when you get somebody in the corner, you're going to go to the body first anyway.
Yep.
So, you know, it teaches you how to use your elbows and stuff. But going to the cardio aspect, I can relate to that too, because my first fight in the competitive ranks down there in college, when I did an exchange program with Virginia Military Institute, I faced a guy from the Naval Academy. And it was a scrimmage, and he demolished me. I mean, it was the first time and the only time I've ever quit in a fight, sparring or, you know, anything. And it was just coming off the summer where I hadn't really worked out, and that was the only lesson I needed because, you know, obviously we were doing intense training after that to get ready for the regular season. And our coach had us run 7 miles through the hills of Virginia every Tuesday. So that was something that really whipped me into shape good. So by the time the regionals came around and I ended up facing the same kid, I beat the pants off of him in the rematch. And that's what allowed me to go to nationals. So that's definitely an important lesson to get under your belt early, that the cardio is very important.
Because I just watched a fight not too long ago. It's Andy Lee, and I forgot the other guy who fought.
The Scottish guy, like McEwen
or something? Yeah. Yeah, the Scottish guy was beating him, and he ran out of energy, ran out of gas, and got knocked out in the last round.
Yeah, and especially when you're in a situation where you're doing 4 or 6 round fights, if you have unbelievable cardio, and you can go 8 or 9 if you had to, it makes a hell of a difference, you know, where some of these guys are just preparing for the actual round amount.
That's cool. I try to do 8 to 10 rounds every sparring session.
Awesome.
When I train people now, and I try to, you know, impart some of my knowledge to them, because, I mean, I trained under a very good, you know, coach up at Lock Haven, very well-known Dr. Cox. And then I also had several good trainers in Philadelphia that really worked for me, and they all brought something new, different to the table. And the one thing Dr. Cox, one of the first things he always told me, we had a very old coach on the team who passed away right after my senior year, but he was always about being in shape. You know, he said when he fought back when he was, you know, a teenager, there was one thing, because I wasn't a big puncher, he goes, but I was fast and I was always in shape. So, I mean, I wasn't going to knock anybody out, but I was going to box their ears off and I could go all night. And that was his, you know, tip to all of us.
Yeah.
And I remember one thing Dr. Cox would always tell us, saying, when that bell rings and that fight's over, don't you dare lay on them ropes. I don't care how tired you are. He goes, you only went 3 rounds. He goes, you didn't do all that much. He goes, I don't care how tired you are. He goes, when that final bell rings, he goes, you don't have to do nothing else. He goes, the fight's over. He goes, show some excitement. Because if them judges are not decided on who they're going to vote as the winner, the guy in better shape will get it. And I remember my year, you know, after really hearing about this, and when it was over, you know, he would always tell you, get your arms up, you know, pump your hands, you know, be excited. And I just remember talking to him the one night, and you know, I was going down to Virginia. I was fighting the main event down at this Richmond Athletic Club. And the kid I was fighting, they knew he was going to bring it to me in the first round, but he wasn't going to have much after that. And he did. He brought it to me. I hit him with a couple shots. I put him down on his knees with an uppercut left hook. But he got up, and he kept punching. And he was out-punching me probably about 4-1 in that first minute. And then he ran out of gas. And another thing I always teach my fighters is if you're tired, don't show it. Whether you have to bounce or whether you have to faint and make it look like you're about to punch and you're catching your breath, make the opponent think you're about to hit them so they don't come straight at you. Well, this guy never subscribed to that theory, because after he went through about a minute's worth of punches, he backed off, he dropped his hands, and he started gasping for air. And I looked at him, and I smiled, and I wanted to make sure he saw me smile to let him know that I knew that he had nothing left. And here I was coming like a freight train.
You got to know how to hide all times of pain. If you're cold, if your body fat, you got to know how to hide it. Because that's the slightest, not show of any kind of pain, can change the whole fight.
Right. And that's what I did. I brought it right to his body, right to the rib cage.
Let's take the rest of the air out of him.
Yeah.
And another thing, I talk about your left hook. You know, one of the things that I used to teach when I was a coach for the club team of my school is the Tyson left hook. You know, so a lot of people notice he had a great uppercut, but it's interesting to look at the way he threw his left hook. You know, if you watch the knockouts from the left hook that he used to throw, it's all on the legs. You know, he had some huge calves, and a lot of people think throwing punches and especially hooks is in the upper body movement, but it's more in the legs. You know, it's the turning of the balled foot and pushing off the calf power. And he just had some enormous legs, and just that peekaboo style too, mixed in, gave it the torque that he needed to just demolish guys. You know, so if you're go ahead.
He's very solid. Pivots are always one shot pivots.
Right.
Yeah,
that's one thing. Yeah, that's another guy you don't want to emulate the lifestyle of, but definitely the skills are worth watching.
Outside of Jim, he's a totally different person.
Right. And you mentioned Jersey Joe. We Tony and I are big Rocky Marciano fans. So I'm sure you've seen that fight, but he had the right hand out of nowhere. Just unbelievable. And it was kind of like a combination of a straight right and a hook. It was like more of a short hook than anything. So that always fascinated with me because, you know, he was such a light fighter for the heavyweight ranks. He was like a buck 85 fighting heavyweight most of the time.
And even Jersey Joe was only about 195.
Right.
195, maybe 200. It was funny. My one uncle was over the other night, and, you know, he doesn't come over the house very often anymore. And he had come over, and he was down in my gym, and he was looking at some of the fight memorabilia that I have hanging all over the walls. And the one thing that made his jaw drop was the original Tyson, or not Tyson, I got Tyson on the mind, so the original Marciano-Walcott fight program from Philadelphia in 52. And he looked at me, he's like, my God, where did you get that? And I didn't have the heart to tell him that it was originally his late father-in-law that was at that fight that gave it to his brother-in-law, who in turn gave it to me when I was fighting, because his brother-in-law was worried that if it got into his hands or one of the other, one of his own brother's hands, that as soon as they got it, they would sell it. And, hey, money's great and everything. You know, everybody needs money to survive. But there's certain things like that you really need to you can't put a price tag on. And knowing my Uncle Eddie, even though he passed away when I was 7 years old, he really took a lot of pride in being at that fight and having that program and being an Italian. You know, he was really proud of, you know, somebody from his heritage winning the title like that. And it would have been, you know, so if he would have, I mean, if that program got sold to just anybody, he'd be rolling over in his grave. And now the fact that, you know, it's in his great nephew's hands and being framed and hung up in a boxing gym, you know, I know that there's a sense of pride to him, you know, wherever he is right now, hopefully looking down on us, not looking up at us.
Definitely.
But no, Jersey Joe, I mean, I remember watching his fights with Joe Louis, and I still think he won that first fight. Jersey Joe was a very slick guy. If you watch his first fight with, or not his first fight, I'm sorry, I think it was his third fight with Ezra Charles when he finally won the title. I mean, he was just so slick. He did that, you know, he walked away, and then he was just walking towards Charles like he was strolling down the street for a cup of coffee, and then out of the blue, boom, left hook, and Charles is out. And I still consider Charles probably the greatest light heavyweight that ever lived. I mean, the big man has 3 wins, including a knockout over Archie Moore. I don't see any other light heavyweight that would have been able to stand up to him, including guys like Roy Jones, including guys, you know, like Bob Foster, or, you know, really anybody else.
David Jones' footwork, to me, was, for that time, was great.
Right. Yeah, one of the things that bugs me all the time when I see the comparisons between guys like Lennox Lewis and Tyson and, you know, if they ever fought the old guys, people forget, you know, these guys had over 100 fights. That's unheard of in this era of boxing, you know. And it's hard to find even a guy with 75 fights these days. I think like Butterbean is really the only one that I know of, and he was fighting 4-rounders all the time.
Yeah,
and those guys too. The guys that are professional opponents, they have over 100 fights a lot of times.
And I feel like they did more rounds. Like they, I don't see no one in this era really making it 15, 16 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like 12, you see them gasping. So another 4 or 5.
Right.
The fight game has changed from what it was back in the day. Now, you know, everybody pick and choose here and there.
Yeah, there's a lot of building up, more so, I think, than back in the day, you know. And it's interesting because I think these days, because of the Russian situation at heavyweight, the more attention is being put on guys in your area, you know, light middleweight, and welterweight especially, of course, because of Floyd and, you know, him being undefeated and just the class of fighters there. They're not necessarily all American guys that, you know, people support because of that. It's just, it seems like they're the most exciting weight classes because they're the ones who seem to be getting matched up the best.
Yeah. It's like the weight class, those weight classes are full of tons of talent, so no matter, you can't really pick and choose around fighters, because most fighters that's in the top 15 really have talent.
Right.
So you can't really duck anyone, everyone that's in your weight class can fight. And I feel like a lot of people from 140 to 168 has a lot of extreme talent all over the place.
Right.
But even some of the opponents have talent.
So you are you somebody that is looking forward to the, if it ever happens, the Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao fight?
Yeah, definitely.
Are you rooting for Floyd in that one?
Yeah, I'm rooting for Floyd.
Do you think it will happen?
Do I think it will happen? Probably not.
Yeah. Probably not.
You
know,
because
Floyd
has a lot of...
My argument on here, and I said this, I mean, even 7-8 months ago, you know, before Floyd really had a lot of legal issues, my argument for the fight not happening was you get two guys that have a lot to lose, okay? I mean, you got Manny Pacquiao. He is a god in his home country. He is an absolute god. You know, he's political now. I mean, he... you know, brings the morale of the entire country up. Now, he's taking some risky fights. I mean, Miguel Cotto was a very risky fight. Margarito, because he was so big, was a risky fight, even though he ended up being a human punching bag. And his fight, you know, coming up against Shane Mosley, even though Mosley's past his prime, is still a risky fight, because when Shane from time to time can still turn it on. So you got Manny has a lot to lose, and basically he has an entire country that is, like, riding on this fight. Floyd has a lot to lose because Floyd is coming out saying, I'm the greatest fighter ever lived. I'm 41-0. I've never been defeated. Granted, a couple of his fights were closer than they really could have been. The fight against De La Hoya, I mean, a lot of people thought De La Hoya won. I had Floyd winning 7-5. but only because De La Hoya gave him away three of the last four rounds. So you have it where it's like, now, if Floyd goes out there and he loses his fighter, and especially if he gets knocked out, his entire, you know, ego is completely crushed. Now, granted, he doesn't have the same popularity and following that Pacquiao does. He doesn't have a country behind him, you know, but he has Floyd Nation behind him. You know, his, you know, very, his family, his ego. And I don't think he wants to take that risk of possibly, you know, having that get shattered. And great fighters are willing to take great risks. And I think Manny and Floyd will always figure out a way not to let it happen, but make it look like it's the other guy's fault. Floyd will always say Manny won't take the drug test. Manny always say will always come out and say, well, we gave Floyd this concession, but he wanted more. He wouldn't meet us mid-ground. They'll always find a way not to let it happen, where guys like Ray Leonard and Tommy Hearns found a way to make it happen. Guys like Jake LaMotta and Sugar Ray Robinson found a way to make it happen. And that's where real greatness comes in.
Because back then, everyone had to rather fight than have to fight for them. That's why they say there were a lot more champions back then than there are now.
Right. So, what do you think about this MMA? Do you watch any of that? Are you worried about boxing getting fans taken away from going over to watch more MMA?
No, because at the end of the day, MMA is exciting. Huh?
Go ahead.
MMA is exciting, but it can never take real boxing fans away from boxing just because of the pure skill it takes to box. Anyone can get lucky in basically a street fight where you could throw a lucky punch and knock the other guy out or take him down. But boxing and MMA will never be on the same level. Like, MMA is fun to watch, but at the end of the day, I feel boxing will always outshine MMA.
That's what I say. Thank you.
Well, I mean, we actually had a whole MMA versus boxing debate. We had a bunch of experts on, and this was like years ago when even Floyd was talking trash about MMA as a fad and a gimmick. And, you know, I always thought it was interesting that not a lot of people realize the thing that boxing has that MMA doesn't is it's all over the world. You know, it's sanctioned everywhere. There's just about every single country has a famous boxer, or at least has a place where they put on boxing fights, whereas MMA, it's not everywhere. You know, it's not even in every state at this point. So the other thing is that there's just so many more fights that the safety issue, you can't even compare it. You know, like, of course, yeah, there's been boxers who have been killed in the ring, but, you know, MMA is so young. There's not enough statistics to really show whether it is dangerous, you know, or more dangerous than boxing. And one of the things that I saw was a study that showed that MMA guys get way more concussions than boxers. So, and one of the things that we came out with a debate too is the press with boxing. The press is so much more ingrained, and it's the history of it too. The history has just been around forever, so. Like we talked about, there's guys with 100 fights at one point, and the only history with MMA is down in Brazil. You know, those guys originated it.
A lot of those guys, all the champions, if you look at how the whole rank works, you can be like 12 and fight for a world title and just have one win.
Right.
So it's like, it's not really that organized. It's like anyone can be a champion in MMA. You can walk on a scene and fight a champion. You'd be 6-0 and fight a champion that's like 19-12, knock him out and you're a champion. And you're the greatest MMA fighter ever. Because I love you.
Right. Well, there's so many different organizations and circuits. It's really, you know, kind of just dwarfs the problem in boxing with the sanctioning organizations, because, you know, at least in boxing you have three or four major sanctioning organizations that are recognized across the board as the big ones, you know, whereas in MMA there's pretty much just one big league and all these feeder leagues. And, you know, there's so many different belts, it's unbelievable. And then even then, you know, a lot of these guys can't fight each other. So it's really a mess. It probably never is going to get fixed. You know, and boxing has its issues with belts too, of course. You know, there's obscure belts everywhere. But, you know, at least you always have the big three. Well, actually, I think there's more like four or five now. But either way, you know, you still can have anybody fight anybody at any point. And the only issue you're going to have is maybe certain promoters don't like other promoters, but eventually, if somebody's got the belt, you know, they're gonna get the matchup if they want to unify the titles. So,
yeah, definitely. I mean, just the major belts, all those other roundabout belts, it's cute to come to the ring with. It's fun, you know. I'm a champion, but everyone knows the top quality belts from the national, all the belts that lead to bigger belts.
Right.
Maybe one belt's just for everything in that little organization.
Right. Yeah, that's another thing that's kind of interesting. They don't have the they don't have national and intercontinental and Pacific belts at all. It's just one belt, like you said.
What about the cheeseburger belt?
No, in boxing they do. But
in
MMA they don't. They don't have any other belt but the one belt. And we actually had a guest on during that debate, Iceman John Scully. I don't know if you ever heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a pretty big trainer. He actually spars with his fighters all the time still to this day, and he was a former boxer himself. And he made it the point that, you know, it's like these alphabet organizations are getting a little out of control in boxing, but he can understand the reasoning behind it to some extent, you know, why there's so many different types of belts out there, because as bad as some people might think it is for the sport, it's good in other ways because it gives some of these younger guys something to fight for and something to be proud of. In the amateur system, you know, there's so many different circuits you can fight in and try to get a belt. But it's nothing like the professional, getting to the professionals and having some kind of title belt to look back on. But
it gives you that to strap, like, right, I got this belt, there's many more to accomplish, instead of like back in the days where it was just one major belt. And I was like, dang, if only I would have won this fight. Dude, I understand why they make all the different belts, but sometimes they have too many.
Right.
Like, they're like 14 champions in 1 week left.
Yeah, we were just talking earlier, there's a female fight down in Mexico between a girl who was like 26-1 and another girl who was 1-2. And it was for like the WBC youth female belt.
So,
if that girl pulls up an upset, you know, she's going to be 2-2 with a title belt.
Yeah. Give somebody something to fight for.
Right. Well, Dylan, we covered a lot here. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up, or anybody you want to give a shout out to?
Just my training camp, my dad, Dylan Paulson Sr., my second, Leon Taylor, and my advisor, Greg Leon, who's been doing a lot of great things for me. I'm just ready to fight. Hopefully, I'll be a household name soon. I'm just putting in the work to be the best.
Nice. Tony, you got any final questions?
I don't, man. Dylan, it was great talking to you, and I wish you the best of luck in all you do.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep an eye out for you. And, you know, Matt Yano, we're very friendly with him. He's the one that set us up with this. So whenever he's got any news about you that he sends me, we'll get it on the blog. And, you know, we'll get this interview already up at the top of the blog right now. To let people know about it. So keep that up through the night, and we'll definitely keep in touch and keep following you. And best of luck, like Tony said. But sounds to me like you're working hard enough where you won't need it.
I'm trying. I'm getting improving every day.
All right, great. Well, it's awesome having you on, and keep up the good work.
All right, thanks a lot.
Have a good one. So there we have it. That's Dylan Parsley. We didn't get the explanation on where he got his name, but it's interesting. His father had the same name as a heavyweight. Didn't have as good a record, though. But like we said, we'll keep an eye on him. Sounds like he's got his homework done. He's ready for this fight coming up on the 29th. And hopefully we aren't a jinx.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, David Lopez, 3-4, doesn't have a single knockout to his record. He's also got 3 draws. I didn't mention that. 3-4-3. And it looks like all his draws came in his last 6 fights. That's pretty interesting. But let's get back to the box rec schedule. Finish that out before we go and get to the UFC Fight Night 24 event coming up. I've gone through the Cosmopolitan fights there. Got that all set. We have another Friday night fight in Fairfield, California. That's the main event. That's pretty decent. We got Antonio Escalante at featherweight, 24-3 with 15 knockouts, fighting Alejandro Perez, 14-2 with 1 draw and 9 knockouts. That's at the Sports Center in Fairfield, California on Friday night. Put on by Golden Boy. Oh, a former interview subject of ours is also fighting on Friday in El Paso, Texas. Molly McConnell, 10-2 with 5 knockouts, fighting Keita Watkins, who's 6-7 with 1 knockout. And here we go for another belt. The vacant, surprise, surprise, vacant Global Boxing Union female light welterweight title. And there's also a vacant WIBF title on the line, Women's International Boxing Federation for light welterweights. And this is a fight card where there's 2 female fights and one male fight. So that's pretty interesting for El Paso, Texas. And we have a one fight card also that's kind of standing out here in Commerce, California, at the Commerce Casino. We have a light middleweight fight between Jose Alfredo Flores, 45-10 with 26 knockouts, fighting Roberto Garcia, who's 28-3 with 21 knockouts, light middleweight. And that's the only fight listed on this card. I don't know if there's going to be more. They just listed one. What the story is there? And then we go to Hanging Gardens, River Grove, Illinois, for a decent card here. We have 3 big fights. Osumanu Adama, 18-2 with 13 knockouts, fighting Marcus Upshaw, 13-4 with 1 draw, 6 knockouts at middleweight for the vacant IBO Intercontinental Middleweight title. And we have at welterweight David Estrada, 25-6 with 16 knockouts, fighting Leonardo Tyner, 24-4 with 15 knockouts. And light middleweight fight, Joey Hernandez, 17-1 with 10 knockouts, fighting Angel Hernandez, who's 30-9 with 17 knockouts for the United States Boxing Organization light middleweight title. Also vacant.
I'll call him Angel Hernandez.
Yeah, right. Me too. Hernandez versus, I wonder if they're related. You know, it's spelled exactly the same, too. Sometimes it's with an S, but these two are spelled with a Z. I'm just going to check where they're from, just to see if I can figure it out. Toro, Mexico for Angel. And let's see where Joey's from. Twinkle Fingers, his nickname? What? Miami. He's from Miami.
That is a Macho nickname.
That's funny. So this is Joseph Alexander Hernandez from Miami, Florida. I mean, a guy from Toro, Mexico. So I doubt they're related.
Anybody named Twinkle Fingers, I'm sorry.
Well, there's Frank Trigg, who actually trying to book for a future show. He's in the MMA circles. He kind of had an embarrassing loss as his last fight in the UFC. But his nickname is Twinkle Toes. And he seems to be pretty proud of it. You know, he just doesn't seem to be bothered by it at all. And I don't even know if it was his choice or somebody came up with that. But I thought that was a really weird nickname for a fighter.
Do you remember that joke we played on that girl, Laura, the girl that I was training that we had on the show that night?
The potato.
Yeah, that's the one. I was like, yeah, which came up with a nickname for you? What is it? The potato. Potato? What does that mean? I was like, and I stole it right from a movie. It was like this horrible B-movie flick with like Chuck Norris in it. And it was like a Mr. Miyagi like trainer is like training this like loser kid. And they're like, well, what kind of nickname can we give you? Maybe we'll give you, like, the Warrior. Or maybe we'll give you, like, the whatever. No, we'll call you the Dumpling, who beats his opponents into submission by pounding his face into their hands. And so I just substituted Dumpling with Potato. She was pissed. But I got you blamed for it, so.
Yeah, that's always good. Blame somebody who isn't in a position to take the slack.
She still hasn't figured out it was me that sent that off. She's a Steelers fan, and when they lost to the Packers in the Super Bowl, I sent her this Packers poster, and she was like, somebody sent it to me, there was no address, and blah, 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 and she's like, you know, I know it was you, and I'm like, would I really own any Packers stuff? Well, then who else would it be? How the hell do I know? Of course it was me. You know, actually, but it was something like a guy from Wisconsin that sent my dad like 8 years ago, and he just happened to keep. So, you know, it was all pissed off. And then, you know, why am I always the first to be blamed? That's what I want to know. I have this guilty look to myself, I guess.
I guess so.
I don't know why.
Well, we go to Hamburg, Germany for another fight worth mentioning on Saturday. We have Alexander Dimitrenko, 30-1 with 20 knockouts, fighting Albert Sosnowski, who's 46-3-1 with 28 knockouts.
Yes.
And you think.
Yes, Sosnowski had that big fight with Vitaly Klitschko back last year for the title. Klitschko beat him, stopped him in like 10 rounds, but you know, Sosnowski did not embarrass himself by any means.
Right. And you'd think with guys with records like this, you know, they'd be fighting for a big WB or W something.
Title. Guys. I mean, Franco is a good 6'7". His only loss was to Eddie Chambers at Philadelphia. And that was a fight that, you know, Eddie dominated him by using speed. You know, he really outboxed him pretty good. He hurt him with body shots. He knocked him down. And a lot of people figuring that, he's only being the same size as the Klitschko brothers. And the way Eddie dominated him, a lot of people thought Eddie had a chance of beating Vladimir when they fought. But it didn't work out that way because there's a big difference between Vladimir Klitschko and Alexander Dimitrenko. Eddie found that the hard way.
Well, this fight is for the EBU, European Heavyweight title. So nothing world about it, but it ought to be, you know. It's all the other Russians have the title.
Yeah.
You do. There's also, you know, one of the things that the Europeans are known for is highlighting the best female fighters on these big cards, and the co-main event on this card is actually, there's usually only two fights listed, is a 10-round flyweight fight between Susie Kentikian, 27-0 with 16 knockouts, and Anna Arizola, who's 19-5 with 16 knockouts and 3 draws. And this is for the WIBF, Women's International Boxing Federation, flyweight title, and also the WBA flyweight title and the WBO female flyweight title. So it's a big championship card there in Hamburg, Germany, at the Universum Gym, in case you have your passport ready and you're willing to go to great lengths to go see that, Tony. There you go.
Sure. Great.
If we had the budget, send you.
If we had to work, I'll go.
We also have a fight down in Veracruz, Mexico, between Stephane Jamoy, 20-2 at bantamweight, fighting Leo Santa Cruz, 14-0, with 6 knockouts. And the co-main event there is a super flyweight fight between Jose Salgado, 23-1 with 20 knockouts, and Everth Brasino, who's 32-6 with 26 knockouts and 1 draw. You know, there's a whole other big card associated with that, and I'm going to get into. We have a late addition to the mismatch of the week here. Could be beating out that female fight for the mismatch of the century. Lima, Peru, and it's the main event. We have a super featherweight fight between Tony Fernandez, 28-0 with 18 knockouts, fighting Wagner Gonzalez, who is 0-2. It's just mismatches everywhere. There's also a flyweight fight between Alberto Rossell, who's 24-8 and 11 knockouts, and Luis Trejo, who's 0-13 with 1 draw. And if that's not enough, we have one more. We have David Zagara, who's 13-0 with 9 knockouts, fighting Javier Rizo, who's 3-2 with 1 draw. So I guess that's how they do it in Lima. I think their matchmaker should be fired. That's rough. Very rough. That's why, maybe that's why the guy is 28-0. Been fighting guys who were 0-something his whole career.
That really can't hurt, you know?
Right.
Well, I was saying the same thing, right? So a couple of years ago, when I was at one fight card, and the guy in the car was a heavyweight. He was like, you know, 35-0, 32 knockouts. He hadn't fought more than a 6-rounder. And you just knew he was fighting, you know, guys with the, you know, they were brought in to make him look good. And one fight, he was there, he's fighting a guy who was big, but you could tell the guy just, you know, he was a big opponent, to be brutally honest. And I was talking to my friend Willie Gibbs, and Willie said, Tony, don't you got to cover this fight? I'm like, I already did, bro. Tim Burr. That's a fuck. And then a few months after that, this guy was fighting a guy that didn't have a good record, but he fought a lot of good fighters. And if it wasn't, you know, if it was more than a 6-round fight, he would have lost because he was getting his ass kicked in the 5th and 6th round. He was just lucky that the guy was coasting and goofing off and making faces instead of trying to knock him out. And then when he finally stepped up, he got his ass knocked out in 3 rounds. His name is Farouk Saleem. You know, he fought, you know, too many times, and you're not, you know, not taking on the competition. He was just too in-depth in fighting human punching bags. They were ready to fall.
Actually, it's kind of funny you mentioned Timber. That would be a great stage name for a guy who is an opponent. His first name was Tim. His last name was Burr. It'd be like the opposite of the Rocky movies. The guy that always loses, and then he wins his final fight or something.
Oh, dude, you know what was great last week? I mean, it would suck to have to work there, but the one spot in the Philadelphia airport, because I was there, like, checked in 2.5 hours before my flight. So I started wandering around, you know, went to breakfast and all that. And then I was like, yeah, you know what would be awesome? You know, so I'm walking around. And remember, this is in Philadelphia. So what's Philadelphia known for? Rocky. There was a store that I saw. They had like a couple of like, Rocky movies on DVD and some Rocky shirts and all that. I'm like, yeah, I forget. You know, I see these all everywhere. So I go in there, and I was like, oh, geez, man. It was the end of Rocky 1. So I felt the need to stop and watch it. And the woman was like, yeah, we got to play all the Rocky movies on a continuous loop in here.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, yeah, for the first day, that'd be pretty cool. But maybe my third day on the job, I'd probably get a little bit annoyed. I love the Rocky movies.
Interesting. Well, we have a few more fights here worth mentioning. I'm going to skip a few from Russia and with some tough names, but there's an interesting one down in South Africa. We have Steve Molitor fighting for the IBF Super Bantamweight title. He's 33-1 with 12 knockouts, fighting Takalani Ndlovu. I'm probably not pronouncing that right. But he's 31-6 with 18 knockouts. And all around, this is a great card. We also have John Real Casimiro, who's 14-1 with 8 knockouts, fighting Marucci Mithilane, who's 26-2 with 17 knockouts, and that's for the IBF flyweight title. And also a couple guys fighting for the South African lightweight title, Patrick Malinga, 27-6 with 24 knockouts. Two draws, fighting Thompson Makwana, 11-4 with 6 knockouts. And then we're going to skip over the United Kingdom fight, and we're going to go right to the big Atlantic City fight this weekend at the Boardwalk Hall. It's going to be on HBO. 12-round featherweight fight between Euriorkis Gamboa, 19-0 with 15 knockouts, and Jorge Solis, 40-2 with 2 draws and 9 knockouts.
Solis is a very good fighter. And, Gamboa, I mean, he is just phenomenal. I mean, that hand speed is unbelievable. And, Solis is tough, though. I mean, Solis is a guy that he's going to get in your face. And, if anybody can, you know, maybe get in Gamboa's head a little bit and, you know, make him uncomfortable, that's what you have to do to a guy like Gamboa. You have to make him uncomfortable. And so far, nobody's really been able to do that.
Right.
So that's Solis's test right there. He's got to neutralize that incredible speed, and he's got to make the guy uncomfortable.
And we have two fights where somebody's O has got to go on that card. You got Super Bantamweights, Jorge Diaz, 15-0 with 9 knockouts, fighting Tion Kennedy, 16-0.
Tion Kennedy. I've actually covered a couple of Tion fights. Does not known for his punching power, but he's got a very good speed. And, you know, he's a guy that, you know, could definitely make it very interesting for you because of his speed. He uses that. Obviously he's not on Gamboa's level, but that's what he does. He uses his speed to overwhelm you and kind of a substitute for power.
Right. Also, the Gamboa fight is for the WBA Super World Featherweight title. Never heard of a Super World. That's what it's for. And also the IBF Featherweight title. I forgot to mention that. But the big fight, I think, on this card that could outdo the main event is a 10-round featherweight fight between Miguel Angel Garcia, 24-0 with 20 knockouts, and Matt Remillard, who's now 23-0 with 13 knockouts. That is for the NABF featherweight title and the WBO NABO featherweight title. And that's going to be a really good light guy fight, featherweight. That's just a recipe for a war. they're going to be really trying to keep that undefeated streak going, both of those guys. So that's one that I'm going to probably try to watch if I can find it online. Let's see what else we got. Getting into Sunday. Not much at all. Yeah, that's about it until next week. Worth mentioning anyway. Of course, there's a whole bunch of fights, but nothing huge. That HBO card sounds pretty good. The UFC Fight Night 24 is also coming up on Saturday. We're going to run through that real quick. But also, I want to mention that for anybody listening out there, we do have a call-in number. If you want to call in and chat with us, ask us a question, whatever you want to do.
Why am I so awesome?
Like what? Why are you so awesome? Yeah.
Yeah. That's a legitimate question.
Yeah, you could ask that if you really think Tony's that awesome. So you can call us at 347-324-3228. Again, that number is 347-324-3228 if you would like to chat. We'll get that done. And let's talk about this UFC Fight Night 24 while we're waiting. Ultimate Fighting Championship Fight Night 24. We have the main event, Phil Davis versus Antonio Rogério Nogueira. And actually, when I watched that Ariel Helwani show that I was mentioning earlier, Phil Davis was mentioned as a potential future opponent for John Jones. And they're both pretty dynamic fighters, both undefeated. Nogueira is another guy like Hua, who has been around forever. His record is 19-4. And he's coming off a loss to Ryan Bader, who actually John Jones just beat himself before fighting Hua. So it's going to be kind of an interesting measuring stick to see what happens here. But before that loss to Bader, Nogueira had quite a win streak going. He had, 7 fights in a row he had won before that. Pretty interesting. But he's just gotten to the UFC 3 fights ago. With UFC 106, when he fought Luis Arthur Kane Jr. and beat him by TKO in the first round. And he had a decision against Jason Brills that he won, split decision at UFC 114, and his last fight was Bader at UFC 119 last September. And Mr. Wonderful, Phil Davis, is 8-0. That's his nickname. Mr. Wonderful.
Paul Wonder.
He is coming off a fight against Tim Boach. He won by submission. He's, ironically, he's spent almost his whole career in the UFC. He only had 3 fights before making it into the UFC, which is really rare. But he started with UFC 109 in 2000. No, UFC Rumble on... No, that's UFC FC. I'm sorry. There's 4 fights that he had before he got into the UFC, and 4 fights in the UFC. So half his career he's been in the UFC. He broke on the scene in UFC 109, which was February of last year, with a win over Brian Stann. And he actually fought 4 times last year, which is also kind of rare for an MMA guy. He beat Alexander Gustafsson at UFC 112 in April. Then he had fight with Rodney Wallace, won by unanimous decision at UFC 117, Silva versus Sonnen, and Tim Boach versus, Tim Boach was his last opponent, like I said, at UFC 123 in November. So we got that. We also have Dan Hardy versus Anthony Rumble Johnson on this card. Dan Hardy's record is 23-8, 11 knockouts, 4 submissions, and 8 decisions. He's coming off 2 straight losses, George St. Pierre at 111, UFC 111, and Carlos Condit at UFC 120. And his opponent is our former guest, Anthony Rumble Johnson. We had it on a while ago. But just when he found out he had this fight coming up, he's only 8-3, but he's had some tough opponents. He's got wins against Kevin Burns, Luigi Fioravanti, and Yoshiyuki Yoshida in the UFC. He also, before that, lost to Kevin Burns, and he had an immediate rematch. I guess he had an eye injury in the first fight, so he had some kind of an excuse. We also had a win against Tom Spear, lost against Rich Clemente, and a win against Chad Reiner. And he was somebody who had 3 fights before he got into the UFC. So, kind of interesting. His last fight, though, was a loss to Josh Koscheck at UFC 106 back in 2009. So, he's got a lot of ring rust to shake off in this Dan Hardy fight, but we're rooting for him because we had him on the show. And not to mention, Dan Hardy is sponsored by Zion, so we all like that. Amir Sadala is also on the card fighting DeMarcus Johnson. Amir beat the crap out of Phil Baroni. Do we have a caller? I think we might have a caller here. Whatever that is.
Well, I think you heard a beep.
Oh.
That was my computer.
Oh, that was you?
Yeah.
Ew. All right. Well, Amir Sadala is 4-2. His last fight was Peter Sobota decision, unanimous decision, back in November 2010. He had a loss to Dong Kyun Kim before that at UFC 114 in May. DeMarcus Johnson is 12-8. And he had a win over Michael Guinan by submission in his last fight, which was January of this year, round one. He lost to Matt Riddle before that by TKO at UFC Live in August of last year. So we'll see how that goes. Amir Sadala has an interesting fighting style. He's always pretty dynamic, makes for a good fight. We got Aaron Simpson versus Mario Miranda, also on this card. The A-Train, Aaron Simpson, is his nickname. I'm trying to get this to come up here. It's being slow. He's 7-2, Aaron Simpson. He's coming off a win against, no, 2 straight losses against Mark Munoz at UFC 123 and Chris Lieben at the Ultimate Fighter 11 finale, both last year. And before that, he had been undefeated between his 2007 debut and win against Tom Lawler in January of last year by a split decision. Mario Miranda, his opponent, is 10-2 with 5 knockouts, 3 submissions, and 2 decisions. He's coming off a loss to Demian Maia by decision at UFC 118 in August of last year. He also beat David Loizzo before that at UFC 115 in July. No, June of 2010. And his only other loss is to Gerald Harris by TKO at UFC Fight Night 21 back in March of 2010. And John Hathaway versus Chris McCray, Ultimate Fighter alumni. Hathaway is 14-1. His only loss was his last fight to Mike Pyle at UFC 120 in October of last year. He's got wins over Diego Sanchez, Paul Taylor, Rick Story. And he actually made his debut in the UFC on UFC 93 with a win over Tom Egan in January of 2009. And Chris McCrary comes from the Ultimate Fighter a few years ago. He's 5-2, and two of his fights have been in the UFC. He lost both of his fights since the finale. It was his first one against Court McGee. Lost that one in the second round by rear naked choke, and then lost to Carlos Eduardo Roca by knee bar submission at UFC 122 in November 2010. So it seems to me the latest UFC policy is three strikes, you're out. So he might be fighting for his job in this fight. And we have the WEC guys here, Leonard Garcia. He had a tough fight with another Ultimate Fighter alumni, Nazim Fun, who I'm sure they're going to be putting together a rematch pretty shortly. But Leonard Garcia is 15-6 with one draw. He's got most of his wins by submissions, nine of them, three by TKO, three decisions. He won that fight against Nam Phan, but it was a very controversial split decision, and a lot of people thought Nam won that fight, including me. Before that, he lost to Mark Hominick at WEC 51 back in September of 2010. And he's been in the UFC, I mean the WEC for a while. But he's actually one of those guys who fought in the UFC before he went to the WEC. And when he was in the UFC before in 2007, he had a loss to Cole Miller, a win against Alan Berube, and a loss to Roger Huerta. Oh, that's kind of an interesting breakdown there in his career. Then we have his opponent is Chan Sung, the Korean Zombie Jung. He's 10-3 with six submissions, two knockouts, and two decisions. And his last two fights were losses. This is actually a rematch. His last loss was to Leonard Garcia in April of 2010 by another split decision. And after that, he lost to George Roop at WEC 51 in September. So it's going to be a little rematch. See how that goes for Garcia. And we have the battle of the Bruce Leroy's in the next fight. Alex Caceres is the newest Bruce Leroy on the block. He's 4-2, another Ultimate Fighter alumni. He beat Jamal McLennan by TKO in his last fight in 2010, February of 2010. Doesn't list any of his UFC fights on here, though, for some reason. I know he had a loss to Michael Johnson. But anyway, we also have the other guy who calls himself Bruce Leroy, Mackenzie Sommerzier. And I guess he's calling himself Mac the Menace. But he's a WEC veteran. He lost to Cub Swanson, Javier Vasquez, and Vitas Torres Seves. Sorry. All in 2010. And before that, he had a five-fight win streak going. And four of those were in the first round. Three of them by submission, one by knockout. So it's pretty interesting. But I don't know who's going to win this one. This is it's a pretty interesting fight. But I heard that actually Bruce Leroy, the guy from the Ultimate Fighter show, is going to be coming in doing his cage walk with the original actor from the movie that gave birth to the Bruce Leroy legend there, the original Bruce Leroy movie. So he's hoping to have the edge there in the nickname battle. Then we have Sean McCorkle versus Christian Moorcraft. Christian is from the circuit that I used to watch a lot in Massachusetts, KGFX. He's only got one loss on his record. That was in his second UFC fight. He lost to Stefan Struve, who's just notorious for his comebacks. And Struve was getting wailed on, true to form. And it's almost like, you know, that Homer Simpson episode where he takes up boxing.
Yeah.
But still gets punched to death almost, and then he starts fighting back. Well, Stefan Struve is like that. I'm sure he doesn't intend to do it that way, but it seems like, you know, when he's hurt, the best of him comes out somehow. And they did it to Christian Moorcraft in the last fight, and that was December of last year. And it was at the end of the first round. And he beat him. Moorcraft is 6-1. McCorkle, actually. I was looking at McCorkle. Lost in the first round to Stefan Struve. And he's the one that was undefeated before that. And that was actually Christian Moorcraft's first fight in the UFC when he lost to Stefan Struve. And it was in the second round, that's what I thought. It was early in the second round because the first round, Christian was just kicking his ass all over the place. Unbelievably. That was August of last year. It was his UFC debut, and he had been in the KGFX League before that and reality fighting before that. And I actually saw his fight before that live against Lee Bean. And he won that by submission in the first round. Submission from punches, actually. Kind of interesting. And he had some great fights there. And this McCorkle fight's a great chance for him to prove the Stefan Struve deal was pretty much a fluke. But McCorkle's a pretty interesting fighter. Pretty tough guy. It's going to take a lot to beat him. But we'll see. He's got wins over Mark Hunt, Jonathan Ivey, Bobby Favors. Nobody else really jumping out at me here, but this will be his third UFC fight. And they have common losses against Stefan Struve. But, you know, if that's a benchmark, I don't know. Because, like I said, Struve is the comeback king. But McCorkle did lose a little bit earlier than Moorcraft, so we'll see. We also have Mike Russo versus John Madsen, another guy from the Ultimate Fighter ranks. And let's see, Mike Russo is 13-1 with 8 submissions, 3 TKOs, and 2 decisions. The win, last win, was against Todd Duffy by knockout at UFC 114 in May of last year, end of May. And he beat Justin McCulley before that in his first UFC fight in August of 2009. And that was a decision, unanimous decision. John Madsen is a Ultimate Fighter alumni who's undefeated at 7-0. He has had four fights in the UFC. He beat Justin Wren at the Ultimate Fighter 10 finale by a split decision. He had a unanimous decision April of 2010 against Mustafa Al-Turk. A unanimous decision against Carlos Vimala in July of 2010. And a knockout win over Gilbert Edel by TKO, actually, in first round at UFC 121 in October of last year. Then we have Michael McDonald fighting Edwin Figueroa. Michael McDonald is 11-1, 7 knockouts, 4 submissions, and he's coming off a 4-fight win streak. His last win was against Clint Godfrey by submission at WBC 52 last November. That was a first round submission. Before that, he had 3 straight knockouts against Cole Escobedo, Manny Tapia, and Carlos Garces, all for a league called TPF, Tai Chi Palace Fights. This is one of the bigger independent leagues out there now that Strikeforce is owned by the UFC. We have his opponent is Edwin Figueroa, who's 7-0. This is his UFC debut. He's been in King of the Cage. I don't know, KOK, whatever that is. King of Combat, sorry. Not King of the Cage. Combat with a K. For those of you who can't spell. Nobody else really jumps out on his record. I haven't really heard of anybody he's fought, but we'll see if he's the real deal, I guess. In his USC debut. And we have 2 more fights. Johnny Hendricks versus Anthony Waldberger. And Nick Lentz versus Waylon Lowe on that card. Johnny Hendricks is 9-1. It's another guy from WEC fame. He started against Amir Sadala in August of 2009 with a win by TKO. And Amir, of course, we mentioned, is also on this same card. Up until his fight with Rick Story, Johnny was undefeated. Rick Story beaten by unanimous decision at the Ultimate Fighter 12 finale back in December of 2010. And his opponent, Anthony T.J. Waldberger, 13-5. His last win was against David Mitchell at UFC Fight Night 22, which was a unanimous decision. And before that, he fought 4 shark fights. And does have some interesting opponents in his past. He had a loss and a win back-to-back. One against Pete Spratt by Triangle Choke and King Combat 1 back in 2007. And then his next fight with HDNet Fights in October, he lost to Pete Spratt by knockout. And in the IFC League in 2007, he lost to Josh Neer. So he's been around. Interesting record there. Against a lot of interesting folks. And then finally, we have Nick the Carney Lentz, who's 23-2. 20 wins, 3 losses, 2 two draws. 7 TKOs, 7 submissions, and 6 decisions for the wins. He's got quite a win streak going with one draw kind of interrupting it at UFC Fight Night 20 back in January of last year against Thiago Tavares. But other than that, he's got 2 draws interrupting his win streak. He also had a draw with Kyle Jensen at CFX 7 back in November of 2007. So he hasn't actually lost a fight since March of 2007. Actually, St. Patrick's Day, 2007. He lost to Mark Moreno by Dr. Stoppage at X1 Extreme Fighting 2 at the end of the first round. Since then, though, he's had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 wins, including his last win against Tyson Griffin at UFC 123 in November of 2010. And then finally, his opponent, Waylon Lowe, 10-3, 3 TKOs, 3 submissions, 4 decisions. And his last win was at UFC Fight for the Troops 2 in January this year. And that was against Willamy Frary, unanimous decision. And before that, he fought on UFC 119 in September of 2010, had a split decision against Steve Lopez that he won. And in his UFC debut, was UFC 114, he lost to Melvin Guillard by knockout, knee to the body, round 1. I've never seen a knee to the body scored a knockout rather than a TKO. I guess that's what they called it. And so hard in the body, his head went out, I guess.
Yeah.
And before that, he fought in King of the Cage and a bunch of other different leagues. That's it. That's your big card there. As far as the main event goes, Phil Davis and Nogueira, my money's on Phil, although Nogueira has way more experience. I think we're really getting to the time in the UFC where these guys that are known more for their names and their legends are really getting wiped out by these young up-and-coming kids, really, who just have so much more well-rounded games, and they're starting off so young with a more tooled game, I guess. They have more tools in the toolbox, so to speak, because they just have so much better facilities now. They have so many different trainers that these guys can go to. The sports is so much more established for them. And these older guys are just kind of trying to stick to what works when it doesn't really work anymore as well as it used to anyway. So I think we're going to see that in this main event with Phil Davis. And maybe we'll see him fight John Jones down the line. He'd be a good opponent for the title shot if he wins this fight. So we only got about 2 minutes left. So. Oh, 90 seconds. Got the correction. So I'm signing off. I think we're done. Not much else to cover. That was actually a pretty good time.
I gotta get my charger out of the suitcase. I still have a pack.
Alright. Well, until next week, and keep your eye out for the big report tomorrow night. Check out Facebook and Twitter. I might be doing live updates if we can make that happen. And until next time, next week. We shall see you later.
Later.